Hello, and welcome to the County Conversations Podcast, brought to you by Axe Institute for County Government, with support from the University of Florida IFAS. I'm Eric Poole, Director of the Institute, and I'm happy to bring you our new federal podcast series. Each month, we sit down with the Legislative Director for the National Association of Counties, Aaron Hurley, to discuss some of the most important issues, policies, and legislation affecting Florida's counties. All of our conversations are videotaped via Zoom and can be viewed on the Studio 67 webpage under the federal policy banner. Thank you for tuning in and hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, Aaron, we're going to go ahead and get started with our NACO monthly update, our federal update. Thank you for joining us in Tallahassee. And why don't we begin with what's in the news on an hourly basis, and that's dealing with the budget and the appropriations process. And if you wouldn't mind just walking us through what a quote unquote normal appropriations process looks like, and the spending bills, and then talk about the Appropriations Act for 23 and how we got to where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Eric. Hi, everyone. Aaron Hurley with NACO here. Good to be back. So as Eric mentioned, I'm going to start off with an update regarding where we are for government funding, the appropriations process. So let's kind of first take a step back of what typically should happen in the appropriations process, which, to be quite frank with you, the normal version of the appropriations process hasn't happened for quite some time now. So typically, you know, in a perfect world, what would happen is that the very starting point is that the president releases his budget request for the upcoming fiscal year. That serves as a blueprint for congressional lawmakers to take a look at, say, okay, this is what the president, what the White House is looking at to do, and we'll craft our, you know, specific appropriations bills based on that. Really, I mean, Congress hasn't followed a president's budget in quite some time, so they typically do just go ahead and kind of make up their own budgets, kind of as a similar to what previous years have been, depending on if Congress flips from one party to another. So fast forward, we're on Capitol Hill. Typically, lawmakers will start negotiations around appropriations the spring leading up to the next fiscal year. So what happens there is that the process usually starts in the U.S. House of Representatives, where the Appropriations Committee has 12 different subcommittees. So each of those 12 different subcommittees, what they do is that they draft their own independent appropriations bills. From there, once they're agreed upon, the subcommittee will consider those. They go to the larger Appropriations Committee for a vote, and then on to the U.S. House floor. At the same time, the U.S. Senate does start kind of crafting their own appropriations bills. Again, both House and Senate have appropriations committees that they work on. And so the Senate oftentimes uses the House bills as a kind of foundation for how they want to craft their own. So that's typically how it goes. And again, in a perfect world, the Senate would create their own funding bills. They would vote on those. The House and Senate would come together, identify the differences between their two overall appropriations bills, and then they reconcile those differences. They're able to come together as one large funding package that is ultimately passed by Congress and then signed into law by the president. So that is then, of course, those funding bills includes both defense funding and non-defense funding. So like that discretionary funding, think of more of like housing programs, nutrition assistance, like those social safety net programs, disaster funding, and so on. As I mentioned earlier, that really hasn't happened for a number of years. And especially this year is even more unique than past years, and diverges from, again, the traditional process of how it typically goes. Why it's so different this year is because in the U.S. House of Representatives, there is some differences within the Republican Party. You have kind of your more hard right Freedom Caucus members that are not agreeing with other Republicans within their party on funding levels. And then, you know, Democrats are obviously a whole other group. So there's been a lot of back and forth within the U.S. House of Representatives on these funding deals. So with the upcoming deadline, September 30th, so, you know, just 9 days away. With that deadline coming up, and there was really no progress being made in the House, in a very unique situation or kind of a unique step, the U.S. Senate actually went forward in considering their own appropriations bill. So they actually took the lead for the first time, and I don't even know how long. So the U.S. Senate has been in negotiations. They actually, last week, they drafted kind of a smaller funding bill that they're referred to as mini buses, of three different funding packages. The Senate was able to vote on that on cloture last week. And so they're trying to bring a minibus package to the Senate floor this week. While that's happening in the Senate, and those negotiations actually have gotten a little bit stalled as of yesterday, there have been some snags in that minibus that senators were putting together. So that is a little bit delayed as well too. So while all of that is going on in the Senate side, in the House, there has been even, you know, a little bit less progress that has been made, to say the least. So you all probably saw earlier this week, the House was trying to pass a number of bills. They weren't able to do so. On Sunday evening, House Republican leadership did release a discussion draft for a continuing resolution, a CR for short, which is simply just a short-term funding bill that would have extended funding for the government until October 30th. So it would have avoided a government shutdown. It would have kept the government open for another month. But, you know, that was it. Ultimately, what ended up happening there, those members of the House Freedom Caucus completely rejected that discussion draft because the funding levels they felt were a little bit too high, although it did cut 8% from non-defense programs and non-defense spending. So after that discussion draft was rejected by members of the Republican Party, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had to go back to the drawing board with other members of his party to kind of say, okay, what exactly do we want to do? So ultimately, this was just last evening. It looks like House Republicans are moving closer to an agreement on opening a bid for stopgap funding legislation that would ultimately keep the lights on federal agencies beyond September 30th, and then also, you know, possibly pave the way for their chamber to take up its full year appropriations bills. There are still some holdouts on the new negotiations that they've done. The biggest sticking points right now is additional funding for Ukraine, so aid to Ukraine, and then also funding for disaster relief efforts, which we'll talk about a little bit more into detail. So those are the two big sticking points right now. It really, like, the biggest issues are all about funding levels. There are a handful of House Republicans that want to allocate funding at a lower level than what was agreed upon in the 2023 debt ceiling deal. Of course, that was, you know, agreed upon back in May. So they want to have lower spending levels than what was agreed upon. So that's been a huge sticking point there. I will say some of our members were with, some of the NACO members from Minnesota were with Majority Whip Tom Emmer of Minnesota last evening. They're all here in Washington, D.C. Congressman Emmer did state that he does not believe that there will be a government shutdown, that they are really trying to avoid that. So ultimately, we will see. But I think the point is here is that this is one of the most unique situations when it comes to government funding and the process of what it looks like. And at this point, we're not totally sure what's going to happen. But we know for sure that, you know, if we are able to avert a government shutdown, that it will be a short-term funding deal, whether it's to October 31st, November, but we're definitely not going to see any sort of larger funding package. So that's kind of where we are in the process as well, too. I do want to note as well what NACO has been trying to do and collect information for a potential shutdown. We're getting asked by a lot of our members of the members of Congress, as well as their congressional staff, about the impacts that a government shutdown would have on counties specifically. So any information about those impacts that you can send along and share with NACO that we can reiterate to our federal partners would be immensely helpful in our argument for, of course, you know, averting a government shutdown. But that's where we are kind of in a nutshell. I know that's a lot of information. Eric, I don't know if you want me to like focus on any sort of specific points, or we can also open it up to any questions before we move on to the next topic.
Yeah, just to clarify, so if there's a shutdown, does it affect the mandatory spending?
So what happens is, so this is exactly what happens. So when there is a government shutdown, as long as there's like funding in these different federal programs, they can continue operating as is. There is a good amount of these mandatory programs that do have federal funding from like previous years that have carried over. One thing that has been brought up pretty consistently is a question around, okay, obviously counties are mandated to provide specific services by the federal government and the state and the states. So what happens if it runs out of, if like we're in a government shutdown, these services are being provided without any sort of federal funding? The answer to that is that the federal government will reimburse for those expenses. It is on a case-by-case basis, so that is obviously very iffy. And we're trying to figure out exactly what that process looks like. But ultimately, we do know that the federal government is required to reimburse for expenses, again, up to their, you know, we defer to them, but that is part of the process.
And a related question, where does FAA sit in this? Are they considered, where are
so
they?
So FAA, that's a great question. FAA is a total, it's a totally separate situation. And that does obviously need to be reauthorized by September 30th. Both the House and Senate have introduced their own versions of a reauthorization bill. They are very similar. The thing with FAA reauthorization is that it, again, has been put a little bit on the back burner, but we do feel confident, like once Congress is able to address, at least for a short term period, the appropriations and federal funding issues, that they'll turn to FAA. And again, since there isn't like that much reconciliation that's going to be needed between the two chambers FAA bills, we do feel confident in that kind of moving forward fairly easily.
So if they can't agree on anything else, maybe they agree on defense spending, they can still do something with FAA, so there's not a slowdown. Yes. In
yeah,
commerce?
Exactly. Because since that is a totally separate reauthorization, it's kind of like similar to, except smaller, of course, similar to like the Farm Bill reauthorization, how it's like totally, just totally separate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. FEMA funding?
Yeah. Absolutely. So very much related to the standstill of where we are funding the federal government comes in the FEMA funding. You all saw that the FEMA administrator now, I think about 2 weeks ago, announced that the disaster relief fund is running out of money. And so now FEMA will only be able to fund life-sustaining, life-saving, and critical services. So very limited in what they're able to actually provide funding for any sort of activities outside of the definition of those. So what's been happening on Capitol Hill that's part of this whole federal funding process and appropriations negotiation is that there was going to be $14 billion allocated that would be supplement disaster funding and go towards the disaster relief fund. So like I said earlier, that's been a huge sticking point with House Republicans to provide that additional funding. And what would be great, and I know I've been working with Eric as well as Ginger on this, and you all have already reached out to your members of Congress urging emergency supplemental disaster funding. So that is also something that, I mean, is a huge issue. And we've been working with all of the other state associations in addition to FAC to try to get that funding through, since that is obviously a very much an immediate need. So we're a little bit in a standstill right now with that, but that's something that we're pushing hard.
Good. We had on our list to talk about, we have Treasury guidance. I don't know if you want to talk about that briefly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you all may have seen this. It was August 10th, the U.S. Department of Treasury, they released their interim final rule or new guidance for the ARPA State and Local Fiscal Recovery Fund. That was part of an amendment that was passed. It's called the Cornyn Padilla Amendment that was passed in coordination with the fiscal year 2023 omnibus package back in December of 2022. So that Cornyn Padilla Amendment, that was a huge priority for NACO to get it signed into law, because it would allow counties additional flexibility when investing your ARPA state and local fiscal recovery funds. Of course, that's the $65.1 billion in direct funding to every single county, parish, and borough in the country. So now that the interim final rule is out, it's published in the Federal Register, you can start actually using your funds in accordance with this interim final rule, even before it becomes a final rule. So under the interim final rule, now what counties can use their funds for, in addition to the original eligible uses, which was, right, it was replacing public sector revenue, using the funds to address public health and negative economic impacts, providing premium pay to essential workers, and investing in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. So those were the original four categories. So continue using those funds as you have been. Simply what this new guidance does, the Cornyn Padilla amendment does, is that it now allows counties to use their ARPA dollars to invest in, emergency relief from any sort of natural disasters. That's both post-disaster activities as well as pre-disaster mitigation activities as well, which we were really happy to see that pre-disaster mitigation piece that was included. And we worked really hard with Treasury on that. So that was a huge piece. You're also now allowed to invest your funds in a really broad range of surface transportation projects. A lot of those projects align with those under the U.S. Department of Transportation's RAISE program. There are about 24 new programs that obviously have projects under them that you can use these funds for. And also under this eligible use category, you can use your ARPA dollars for the non-federal match for a handful of transportation projects as well. So again, additional flexibility there. I will note on the surface transportation projects piece or eligible use category, it gets a little bit confusing because for some projects, the U.S. Department of Treasury will oversee the administration, whereas the U.S. Department of Transportation will oversee projects for other portions within this category. And then the final new eligible use category is that you can invest your ARPA funds into Title I projects, which is projects under the Community Development Block Grant or CDBG. So, you know, think about housing, economic development, et cetera. You can also use the funds for the non-federal match for certain programs under this this eligible use category too. So a lot of new flexibilities, which we're really happy to see. So right now, since we're in the open comment period, we're urging counties to submit comments in response to Treasury's interim final rule, any sort of concerns that you have. I think, you know, NACO, of course, is going to be submitting comments. I think a big piece here, now that this guidance has come out, that NACO is going to be working on, that is somewhat related, is trying to get the obligation date, which is originally that December 31st, 2024 deadline. We're trying to get that passed or pushed back, by a couple of months, maybe either to summer of 2024 or even back to December 31st of 2025. So that is something that NACO is kind of working on right now with some congressional offices in the House and Senate. But that's where we are in terms of the new ARPA guidance, again, that we were really, really happy to see.
That's unbelievable. I mean, the flexibility is unbelievable at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, y'all did a really good job on that. Do y'all have a sense for how much of that money has not been spent?
Oh, that's a great question. So it's a little bit hard because Treasury is very delayed in releasing the data. They have released data from the April 2023 project and expenditure reports. And Eric, I can share that with you afterwards. It's like that's on the Treasury website. It's you know, public information, but it is still kind of hard to know exactly how much hasn't been spent to date since they are so behind. And also for like the smaller counties, since they only have to report on an annual basis, otherwise there's no way that we're able to collect it, you know, besides on an annual basis. So it is really hard to determine how much actually has been obligated or spent.
If we can kind of go off topic on our agenda, which was kind of loosey-goosey, but Commissioner Starkey has a question, and she says, I'm still wondering if states that have suspended federal health benefits when someone is arrested has been added to any language. Last I heard, the new fix was only for states that had suspended benefits.
Yeah. Aaron, so if there's any sort of changes for the Medicaid inmate exclusion policy piece.
Yeah.
So Commissioner Starkey, there has not been, yes, terminated versus, yeah. So there hasn't been any sort of update on that piece. We are still very much so pushing those two bipartisan bills, the Reentry Act, as well as the Due Process Continuity of Care Act. I will say that the U.S. House of Representatives Behavioral Health Task Force, they actually just released their new annual kind of, it's like a policy priorities report. And they did specifically include those two pieces of legislation that they are trying to, you know, push passage of. So, you know, I think right now what we're trying to do for those two bills is get them included in the Support Act reauthorization. That's like a larger health package. Again, that's going to expire September 30th. So that's obviously a whole other issue, but that is something that we're trying to work on, and we are continuing to push as well, but no changes as of yet.
Awesome. Thank you. You had on our list, the Affordable Connectivity Program and BEAD as well.
Yeah. So just really quickly, just to, round out the presentation. So the Affordable Connectivity Program and the BEAD program, these are both, of course, related to broadband. The Affordable Connectivity Program was authorized under the bipartisan infrastructure law. So it's helped over 20 million households right now. Ultimately, what the program aims to do is that it provides internet, broadband, like to low-income households at a reduced monthly rate of $30 per month. So as I mentioned, it's currently servicing 20 million households. The issue here, though, is that because it was authorized under the bipartisan infrastructure law, it's not permanently funded, right? So funding is going to run out. So what NACO's trying to do, and through this appropriations process specifically, is that we're trying to get a permanent reauthorization of the ACP so that individuals, families, households can continue benefiting from this really, really critical program that very much so addresses the digital divide. So, you know, we are urging county leaders to reach out to their members of Congress, asking them to support permanent reauthorization, permanent funding for the ACP. And I'll also share, as soon as we get off the call and Eric can share with this group, NACO did send a letter to congressional leadership, as well as appropriators, a list of priorities that we want included in a larger funding package or whatever funding package that happens, and the permanent funding for ACP is included. So that's a priority. And then also related to broadband, the BEAD program, another very, very, very significant program that NACO has been tracking. So what has been up with the BEAD program recently, and what it does is that pretty much the overarching goal is to provide connectivity to every unserved and underserved household in the country. And this was also appropriated under the bipartisan infrastructure law as well. And so what's happened is that, and we were kind of waiting for this for quite some time, is that back in June, the White House and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA for short, they announced the state allocations that are being distributed through the BEAD program, which would provide that broadband deployment infrastructure to every single one of those households. So now that the states do have their state allocations, what they're doing is that they are now charged with developing and submitting their initial proposals to NTIA. So states are very much so in the process. After that June date, states have 180 days to submit their proposals to NTIA. And then after that, that's their initial program or approval program that they would submit to NTIA. After that, they have another year to submit their final plans. So just a couple of action items for counties. Now that we are in the process with these state broadband offices, they know how much funding they're going to get. What we're recommending that counties do is first develop data and engage in strategic planning for serving your unconnected residents to high-speed internet. This could be through collaboration with local internet service providers, I think conducting a needs assessment would be really helpful as well too. Another action item for you all is to assess your county's current and future needs with respect to broadband availability, as well as infrastructure deployment challenges as well. A third piece to this is, and there's just one more after this, is to advocate for your county's vulnerable community through targeted outreach and convening events so that you're able to demonstrate to your state broadband office, hey, this is a really critical need in my county in these specific communities. And then the final piece to this is apply as a subgrantee with your state, because counties are eligible for direct funding as a subgrantee through the BEAD program. So we're really urging folks to work closely with their state broadband offices, because this is a great opportunity to receive direct funding and working with your state to connect residents. So those are the two pieces that I wanted to bring up related to broadband.
Awesome. I guess last is, a couple months ago, we did a policy deep dive with you on WOTUS because of the Supreme Court's ruling on that. And I think there's an interim final rule out that you want to talk about.
Yeah. So actually, instead of a interim final rule for the waters of the United States, what EPA actually ended up doing, EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, is that they just simply produced a final rule. Sometimes that this can happen, there's special circumstances. I will say NACO has voiced our concern via a letter with other state and local groups saying, you know, we really would have liked consultation during this process. You should have done an interim final rule rather than a straight out final rule. But that's all to say, the two agencies did release their final rule back at the end of August. And so pretty much what it does is that it simply just narrows the scope of which waters are federally regulated. So that is a win for counties overall, right? I think the biggest issue though now, and kind of a standstill or kind of limbo of where we are right now, is that we don't know if it applies to certain county-owned infrastructure. So while we're happy that there's a narrower scope, so like streams and wetlands are like not included in this anymore or are considered waters of the United States anymore, we still are seeking clarity on like what sort of county-owned infrastructure will still be impacted. There's some good, still some questions up in the air. NACO, we're actually planning to release our analysis of the new WOTUS final rule later today. So definitely be on the lookout for that on our website as well too.
Aaron, can I ask a question without getting into tripping into the political world? If a different party takes over the executive branch of government in a couple of years, are we going to see this thing ping pong back and forth?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think right now, I will say, with the Supreme Court rejecting that significant nexus test, which is that was like the biggest issue, and like adjacent, those were the two biggest terms or definitions that were really expanding the scope of waters of the United States. I think with them finally rejecting that, I do think that this is a much more of like a middle ground rule. But that's all to say, yes, we could continue seeing the ping ponging back and forth, unfortunately. And, you know, I mean, the whole other process of like the fact that some states aren't even like under this specific rule, they're like 24 that are under their own version of WOTUS as well. So it's like the never ending story, I feel like.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. There is somebody raising their hand. And any substantive changes to WIOA?
So regarding WIOA, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, there haven't been any substantive changes, Commissioner Starkey. We can highlight the exact, like they're very minimal, but we can highlight those exact ones and then share that with you offline via email.
Thank you for that. And two last things that I forgot to ask you is, with the 23 Appropriations Act, they brought back earmarks.
Yep.
How does Congress view those? I mean, because there were a lot of them. And I know some members in the past were very, very critical of earmarks, but we had a lot of earmarks in 23. And so what about going forward?
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like they're here to stay. I mean, honestly, in terms of the earmarks or the congressionally directed spending, whatever we want to call them now, that funding has benefited both sides of the aisle considerably. So it's kind of panning out for everyone. It doesn't seem like there's too much opposition towards it because it has been benefiting communities all across the country.
But you don't think this is part of the discussions on the budget and the okay?
No. I mean, you can even see that, you know, I mean, even when it comes to like reducing federal spending, actually for the earmarks, congressionally directed spending, the funding actually went more towards more Republican leaning states. So in terms of like cutting the budget, that's, I feel like that's kind of a demonstrates that that's something that will definitely stick around.
And the last thing I forgot to ask is on the FEMA immediate needs funding policy, you said everything, unless it's a life critical.
Yeah, it's life threatening, life sustaining, or critical service.
So
is how FEMA is defining it.
So if my assumption would be Cedar Key, Levy County, Florida was impacted by Hurricane Idalia.
Yeah, so those are considered. Yes, those are considered. So that's exactly why they're limiting the funding, is so events like those, like the hurricane, they would be able to respond specifically to those types of situations.
So debris cleanup would be immediately reimbursable under that. And my assumption would be, you know, individual assistance for housing, that sort of thing would also fall into that category.
The only eligible work allowed will be debris removal, emergency protective services. Those are the two. And I'll put that.
So that's just under the public assistance category. What about individual assistance for the impacted resident?
But I can definitely look into the details of that. And then Eric, I'll follow up with you for you to share that information with the group too.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Because if housing assistance is sort of on the cutting block, we would really ramp up the noise level from Florida to our congressional delegation. So, all right. Thank you for today. I don't know how you keep all of this information in your head from A to Z. It's really awesome. And I just would point out to our members that every other month for Thursday, we could do a policy spotlight or a policy deep dive. And before we started this, Aaron and I talked about the National Flood Insurance Program, which is due to expire September 30th. There's also an issue with their new risk rating 2.0, which is how they set the insurance premiums. And there's a lawsuit that's going on that Florida is a part of. So we're hoping to talk about just a little bit of all of that. So just FYI. So with that, Aaron, we're going to let you go. And thank you for taking the time to share all this great information with us.
Of course. Always happy to be here. Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.